some backstory. Jesus of Nazareth was a Jew, a rabbi. In the spirit of the Hebrew prophets of old, for whom social transformation had been a matter of spiritual transformation, Rabbi Jesus invited his fellow Jews to practice their faith with terrific vigor and ardency, and this with an eye toward national renewal. He lifted up the ancient law of Moses, committed obedience to the Torah, to the commandments, was to set off Israel as a counterculture within the empire. Jesus imagined that the moral seriousness of the Jewish people would be so innately compelling and suasive as to draw out the Roman world from its degeneracy, and that thus a new age of fraternity and flourishing would dawn. Spoiler alert, Jesus died. And in the time between his death in Jerusalem and Paul's writing to the Romans, in the 20 or 30 years that had passed, two strange somethings happened. The first strange something: there were sightings of Jesus of Nazareth. No small number of people put forward what was, even then, a remarkable and bizarre, frankly unbelievable claim that they had been visited by the dead rabbi. Some 500 or so insisted upon having had, now call it what you will if you are the skeptical sort, they insisted upon having had a mystical encounter with Jesus. The second strange something, which is much less odd, but curious all the same: the teachings of Rabbi Jesus, the teachings of Jesus were taken up in earnest by Gentiles in every corner of the empire. Non-Jews found themselves drawn to the pathos and the moral clarity of Jesus' kind of Judaism to a degree that Jews just never did. Now, this dynamic, quite a lot of Gentiles thinking that they could out-Jewish the Jewish, and the Jews thinking just like, this dynamic created a colossal disturbance. And to appreciate the magnitude of the confusion and the upset, which is modern Christians who know how the story ends, you know, this can be kind of difficult. Consider by way of an analogy the relationship of 19th century American Protestantism to a little upstart sect called the Latter-day Saints. Our good Congregationalist great-great-great-grandparents, beyond flummoxed at what they saw as a disgraced charlatan locating in the scriptures unusual new meaning they denied to be there. Our good Congregationalist great-great-great-grandparents, they said, you are not one of us. To which the Mormons replied, maddeningly, we are more you than you. While the Protestant establishment, with all the advantages of power, could exert itself against Joseph Smith and his followers, the Jews of the Roman Empire, a small minority themselves, in the best of times merely tolerated, and in the worst of times under threat, The Jews of the Roman Empire could not do much about the little upstart sect troubling their communities. And their communities, indeed, were troubled. Gentiles, intrigued by the Judaism of Jesus, overran the synagogues, causing uproar and schisms. For centuries, in fact, well into the 400s, Christians continued to worship in synagogues. We might still be worshiping in synagogues had not resentful pastors grown annoyed with the rabbi's sway over their parishioners and forbade the flocks from stepping foot inside of them or observing the Sabbath or celebrating Jewish feasts, etc. You can read John Chrysostom's sermons for a real treat. But that is all the backstory. The story, then. The community in Rome to which Paul wrote knew this tumult well. The community was comprised of devout Jews who believed Jesus had called them into a deeper practice of Judaism and of non-Jews who claimed this Judaism for themselves, or rather who claimed most of this Judaism, the Judaism of Rabbi Jesus, for themselves. As Rabbi Jesus taught, they forsook the gods of their youth, henceforth to go sorrowing and rejoicing to the God of Israel, the God of Israel only. They served the God of Israel by serving those for whom the God of Israel had a special love: widows, orphans, the poor, the dying, the alien. They took up the Torah in joyful devotion, all but what seemed to them to be one teensy, tiny part of the Torah, which Jesus had not said much about anyway. No matter how desperately the Jews tried to convince these would-be Jews that, to the contrary, in the symbolic universe of Judaism, this small issue was no such thing. Still, the Gentiles, wouldn't you know, the men among them, still, the Gentiles would not give. They would not be circumcised, would not undergo that ancient rite of initiation by which belonging was sealed and one's crossing over from them to us was celebrated. Parenthetically, another spoiler alert. If you've never read the New Testament, you might be surprised to know that maybe a third of it, a good hearty chunk of it, is taking up this most edifying matter of circumcision. Happy reading. Well, soon outright conflict raged, with Jews insisting that the Judaism of Jesus was Judaism, and that as such all the obligations of Judaism appertain, and with non-Jews insisting that the Judaism of Jesus was of Jesus, and that this somehow changes things. Paul's interest in writing to the Romans was pastoral in nature. He wanted to keep this community from rending itself. He was struggling to bridge these seemingly irreconcilable differences and to speak across premises and assumptions that were not shared. Much of what Paul said to the Romans was born of exigency and served his purposes of placating the stubborn. On the one hand, he needed to appease the Jews and affirm the abiding significance of Jewish identity as they had always understood it. And on the other hand, he needed to appease the non-Jews and affirm the novel and unusual Jewish identity they had come to form. Given the particularities of this conflict, what Paul had to do then was to praise the law and at the same time push the law somewhat to the side. So, in a conciliatory overture to the Jews, Paul celebrated. He celebrated the moral, spiritual trying that the law makes possible. The law, it holds the attention to matters of ethical significance. It quickens the conscience. It facilitates the choice of right over wrong. The law, Paul said, the law is good. Well, this guy's right, the Jews would have thought. But for the sake of the Gentiles, Paul, in the passage we heard read this morning, Paul took a sharp turn. He exaggerated the sense of frustration and distress that comes when moral, spiritual trying leads, as of course it sometimes will, to moral, spiritual failing. The law, Paul said, the law is good, but it makes us feel bad. His intent here was to subtly impugn the Torah, to insinuate that the gift of it is in fact a burden, the blessing a curse. The guilt that comes from trying and failing to keep its commandments, the guilt is so enfeebling, Paul argued, that one can only conclude that the struggle of obedience is not conducive to religious flourishing. Loosen up about the law, Paul advised. Loosen up about the law for your own sake, and, by the way, for the sake of those Gentiles who cannot bring themselves to keep it to your liking. The polemical tenor of Paul's rhetoric reflected the hot, emotional charge of the context in which he wrote. His argument was somewhat overdetermined by his need to win it. And in that, the whole thing was undermined. Methinks the apostle doth protest too much, came the response of the Jews, who rightly saw that Paul took the burden of compromising to be theirs alone to bear. Conflict never did die down, and slowly there was a cleaving of the community. The Judaism of Jesus became Christianity. This may have been inevitable, but it was not at all inevitable that Jewish piety be maligned, be saddled with negative associations and unfair characterizations in the process. Paul had no idea that his words, the words of a Jew speaking to other Jews, Paul of course had no idea that his words would supply the imperial church of later centuries with aspersions to cast and anti-Semitic tropes to trot out. Maybe you've heard some of these. The shaking, guilt-racked Jew, troubled of soul, but too stubborn or too stupid to see that Christ would save him from the futility of trying and failing, trying and failing. Paul had no idea that his words would be weaponized, but they were. And to this day, they are. Christians turn them upon Jews. Protestants turn them upon Catholics. Fire and brimstone preachers turned them upon their parishioners. But this need not be so. It seems to me that the law and that the life of moral struggle, of trying and sometimes failing, but of trying, the law is not a problem that Jesus solves or a quagmire Jesus saves us from, but rather the law is a joy which Jesus shares with us. Grace is not a remedy for the guilt we feel in falling short. Grace is the very gift-givingness of God. Grace is a shorthand for the movement, the eternal movement of God toward us in generosity and benevolence, manifest first in the law, in the gift of guidance on the journey of life. And then, to circle back and back to that most important, wonderful, strange something. And then in the gift of an encounter with Jesus, in the gift of a mystical knowing that we are accompanied, are companioned in the work of obedience, are cheered and strengthened for love's and for goodness' sake by nothing less than the presence with us and in us of love and goodness' sake.